Hello and welcome. I'm Pooja Sarkar and you're listening to the podcast from the bookshelves of Forbes India. Now, just 10 days before our city Mumbai went into the lockdown, we launched our first episode. Since then, it has been a wonderful ride with guests like Thomas Piketty, Asa Damodaran, Stephen Schwarzman, David Rubenstein, Rajat Gupta, R.C. Bhargava and so many more. Usually, I talk to the author about his book and their journey of writing the book. But for our finale episode of our first season, I have invited, drum rolls please, Janta ka favorite Vivek Kaul, who has recently written his book on the Indian NPMS called Bad Money to discuss Viral Acharya's book, Quest for Restoring Financial Stability in India, and talk more about banking, the mess that is being created by the PSU banks, the need for fiscal dominance, and much more. A big shout out to Manswini Kaushik, who has painstakingly edited all the episodes. And as a bonus, today's show will be launched as a video episode too on our Forbes India YouTube channel. Please do like us, subscribe, follow us, and of course, if you like our show, please share it with others. Now, before I get started with today's conversation, I would like our listeners to know that we are leaving with a promise to come back in November. I'm just taking a month's break and see you on the other side. But right now, let's speak to Kaul Saab. Thank you so much for being on our episode. Now, the first thing I wanted to understand, you know, in the chapter on NPAs, Dr. Acharya has written that, you know, recognizing losses just ends up being a strategy of kicking the can down the road and leaving them as legacy assets for the next management to deal with. What does he really mean by this? And also, we have been seeing it for the fact in the Indian PSU banking system, at least, that a manager does not want to really take any call because what if tomorrow there's an action taken against them? So passing the can down the road has been the best that managers have managed to do in PSUs. What is your view on it?
Right. So see, you know, there are multiple points here. Now, the first point is that CEOs of public sector banks, unlike the CEOs of private sector banks, do not spend a lot of time at the top. So if you take even in a bank like an SBI, the CEO typically spends around 5 years at the top. Whereas if you compare it with something like an HDFC bank, you know, HDFC banks till it from its inception has had just one CEO. Who retires next month. Even in case of other private sector banks, these CEOs have a longer tenure at the top. So the fact is that given the given that the CEOs of public sector banks have short tenures at the top, they really don't want any trouble while they are there. They just want to sort of enjoy their time at the top and then retire peacefully and then make some money by joining boards of private companies all across. So nobody wants any trouble. So basically what happens because of this is that the banks are all looking at ways to essentially kick the bad loan can down the road. So if you look at the period between 2011 and 2015, when the bad loans in the Indian banking system actually built up, the situation reached a stage where restructured loans were greater than bad loans. So which basically means restructured loans are loans wherein you have reduced the interest rate or increased the tenure or postponed the payment of principal for a while and so on. So restructured loans essentially reached a stage where they were more than bad loans. So this was essentially, PSU banks kicking the can down the road because no one really wanted any trouble while they were at the top. Now, the consequence of this was that when in 2015, the RBI cracked down on banks, the bad loans in the system suddenly shot up. This did not mean that, these bad loans suddenly started to happen after 2015. They were always there. It's just that the banks hadn't recognized them.
True. Now, in a 2016 interview, Dr. Acharya had said that once you have the name of the country on a state or a state's name in the name of the bank, for example, when you see a State Bank of India, the depositor knows implicitly that the bank is very safe. Now, that has been the perception always that, I remember in your book also, you have given this very clear example, how people had run away from Yes Bank, depositors moved away from Yes Bank. But if you see the other banks, the state banks, which even had higher NPAs, still continue to have depositors. And his book, he further continues to write that, you know, ironically, the presence of a large safety net of deposit insurance and state ownership, which ensure that there are likely to be no bank runs, end up eroding any disciplining force that gets the bank health restored. So basically, I mean, what does he really mean by that? And how do you see this entire issue of people trusting these state banks? It is as if the way, as we always discuss, how people trust LIC just because, you know, the front page says the sovereign has backed your paper.
So, you know, essentially, if you look at the names of public sector banks, so, you know, you either have the name of the country, which is India, in them, or you have name of a particular state. So you have State Bank of India, Central Bank of India, you know, Union Bank of India, Bank of India, or you have, you know, Bank of Maharashtra. There used to be the State Bank of Travancore, State Bank of Hyderabad, Punjab and Sindh Bank, Punjab National Bank. So what happens is, because of this, you know, there is this thing in the head of the depositor that, you know, okay, all these banks are backed by the government, and because of that, whatever happens, they are very safe. You know, this is something that, you know, it's a question that I keep asking myself over and over again. Take a bank like an Indian Overseas Bank or IDBI Bank. Now, these banks had non-performing assets or bad loans of more than 20%, even more than 25%. In fact, IDBI Bank had bad loans of close to 30-33%. So despite that, people continue to have deposits in these banks. So you know, and the reason was because, you know, they thought that the government is behind these banks. Now, what that does is that it essentially leads to a situation where the banks do not do the right thing. Now, how does that happen? Now, if there is a fear of depositors withdrawing their deposits, and you know, it is ultimately deposits which fund loans, banks would make a sustained effort in order to ensure that you know, the loans that have been defaulted on are recovered to a large extent. Now, because there is no there is no bank run, and because the deposits continue to be with these banks, what happens is that the kind of effort that is required to recover a bad loan is not made. The second thing that happens is, obviously, the banks know that you know, the government won't let a bank fail, so the government will continue recapitalizing these banks. So in fact, you know, just before, I think yesterday or day before, it was announced that the government is going to put 20,000 crores more into public sector banks. So this is something that has been happening over the years, and lakhs of crore have gone into the public sector banks to ensure that they continue to be in operation. So because they are government owned, there is no incentive for public sector banks to essentially chase defaulters. So which is what which is what Dr. Acharya means here.
Okay, and why is it that banks which are in trouble keep giving out these riskier loans? I mean, if you look at the NPA numbers, it is these state banks which have continually been giving out these risky loans to corporates and larger corporates.
Yeah, so essentially, see, I can give you a football analogy, and I can give you a cricket analogy, or in fact, I'll give you both. So what happens in football, and I mean, you must have seen this, that when the time is about to run out and a team is trailing, let's say 2-1, and the goalkeeper has to take a goal kick, he typically, you know, does not pass it to a player around him, but what he does is he kicks it with a lot of passion, and ensures that the ball lands deep into the other team's half. And the hope there is that this guy, you know, some of his, some other player of his team will get the ball and be able to score a goal. Now, obviously, this is a very high risk strategy, but it's a high risk, high return strategy, right? A similar analogy in cricket would be that, let's say you're playing a 50-over game and the team batting first has scored something like a 375 or you know, a very high score. Now, one way to play the game would be that, you know, you bat out the 50 overs and you end up with whatever, 300, 325 and lose the game by 50, 60 runs. The other way to play the game would be to go all guns blazing from the first ball. And, you know, who knows, you might just end up chasing the score down. But the problem with that strategy is that, you know, you might also end up being, you know, something like a 220, 225 all out in 30 overs and end up losing by a larger margin. So, so a similar sort of thing happens with banks where, you know, which are in a mess. So what they try to do is, and you know, Dr. Acharya explains this in his book beautifully, where he writes that, you know, there are two ways. One is evergreening of existing bad debt, throwing more money after the bad so as to help the borrower repay the past loan. So essentially what you do is you give the borrower a new loan so that he repays the past loan and there are no NPAs. So now you have a new loan and then the new loan can be a problem, you know, a few years later or a problem for someone else. Now, what you've done here is you've not acknowledged the true quality of the loan and simply kicked the can down the road, something that we just spoke about. The second thing that happens is you give out risky loans in the hope that, you know, you'll get higher returns. And that is essentially a last-ditch effort to rebuild capital quickly. Or, you know, as Dr. Acharya puts it, doubling up bets in a casino when the first round of gambling has all gone sour. So, in fact, there is a, you know, since we've spoken about football and cricket, there is a similar strategy even in American football, and they call it the long bomb strategy. And what happens there is similar to what happens in football. And, you know, there's an economist called Frederick Mishkin, and he writes in a paper called The Economics of Money, Banking and Financial Markets. And he says that when a football team, and by this he means American football and not soccer, is almost hopelessly behind and time is running out, it often resorts to a high risk play, the throwing of a long pass to try to score a touchdown. Of course, the long bomb is unlikely to be successful, but there's always a small chance that it'll work. If it does not, the team has lost nothing, since it would have lost the game anyway. So that's what's happening here, Pooja.
Okay. Now, one of the things that RBI came to be known under Dr. Urjit Patel and Dr. Acharya was the PCA, that is the Prompt Corrective Action framework of banks. And as Acharya writes, undercapitalized banks could be shown some tough love and be subjected to corrective actions like the revised PCA guidelines. Also, the fact, if I am not wrong, while reading Mr. Patel's book, I remembered there was this line where he did not mention the name of the book, but he clearly said that the government comes in and there are some newer rules that are brought in, or somehow the bank, which is not supposed to slide out through the PCA, actually was able to slide out. So these are some examples that they both have shared, and also they both were there at the same time. Can you explain this in some detail for our listeners?
Sure.
This is something very important.
Right. So Pooja, you know, I don't know how many old movies, black and white movies you've seen, 50s and the 60s. Now, there used to be this recurring theme in these movies where, you know, the hero would be unwell and the doctor would tell the hero ki inhe hawa pani badalne ki zarurat hai, something like that. And the hero would promptly land up at a hill station and fall in love with the gaon ki gori. And, you know, there are multiple films up until the, you know, late 60s, which have had this track. Now, the point here is, I mean, why am I using this analogy, is that, you know, the hero had to go to the hills in order to heal himself, right? So along similar lines, the basic idea under the prompt corrective action framework was to allow a bank to heal. So essentially what you did was that the banks, I mean, and you know, there are complicated rules around this, but you know, I'm sort of making this simple for the audience to understand, that the banks are not allowed to sort of give out fresh loans, neither are they allowed to take on fresh deposits. So you just sort of put them in a hospital and allow them to heal. Now, Viral Acharya actually, he discusses this in his book, and he says that such action should entail no further growth in deposit base and lending for the worst capitalized banks. This will ensure a gradual runoff of such banks and encourage deposit migration away from the weakest banks, public sector banks, to the healthier public sector banks and private sector banks. In my book, I looked at data and sort of came to the conclusion that something like this happened, and the banks were in the process of healing, but then the government sort of took them out of the PCA framework quickly. I mean, this is after Dr. Patel and Dr. Patel quit, and Shaktikanta Das took over. Now, what essentially is happening is an efficient, and as Dr. Acharya says, an efficient reallocation of credit for the real economy with a financially stable distribution of risks across bank balance sheets. Now, what this means in simple English is the fact that banks which can take on the risk actually take on the risk, and not banks which cannot take on the risk. So this was one of the good things that happened, I think, between in 2017 and 2018, and is responsible to a large extent for the revival of public sector banks, whatever little revival has happened. I mean, along with the fact that the government has constantly kept pumping money into these banks.
True. I'll just move away a little from the banking system and this question, because when I was reading the book, I felt that, he starts by the entire FRBM Act, that the government has been missing the targets the targets when it comes to our fiscal deficit. And it's been happening for some time now. And he talks about how we have to look at the longer term, and also that the RBI should also be a little independent in its nature to be able to set their own goals. What do you think of that? Because if we look at it in today, I mean, of course, this year has been a washout year, and that's why the government, if the government obviously can't meet the fiscal, the disinvestment numbers, which will be still be acceptable. But if we see last year also, the government could not actually meet its disinvestment numbers.
Yeah. So, you see, here's the thing, even in the years the government has actually met the target, it has met the target by doing what in Mumbaiya language we would call gochi, essentially
selling to each other.
In a sense, I'll tell you, one of the most basic things about government accounting is that unless money leaves the government account, unless cash actually leaves the government's account, it is not recognized as an expenditure. Unless money actually comes into the government account, it is not recognized as a receipt. So how does the government meet its fiscal deficits? I'll give you an example. You get ONGC to buy HPCL. Now, what happens because of that? ONGC buys HPCL, pays the government some 36,000-37,000 crore. In the process, it ends up using its own cash. It also ends up taking on debt. Now, if this thing hadn't happened, a government company buying another government company, the debt that ONGC took on would have ended up on the books of the government. But through this way, the government essentially ensures that the debt doesn't end up on its books. Or take a much bigger problem, take something like the off-budgeting that happens with FCI is that, when the Food Corporation of India buys rice and wheat directly from the farmers, and it sells it at a very subsidized price. So obviously the difference the government has to compensate for. And it never does compensate for the huge difference. So, from what I remember, in 2019-20, the government had the total bill of FCI was more than 3 lakh crore. And the government probably ended up paying around a lakh crore. So there was obviously a gap of 2 lakh crore. Now, obviously, this 2 lakh crore, the FCI has borrowed from somewhere, right? And it has been given that money primarily because it is ultimately backed by the government. So the debt may not be on the the debt may not reflect in the fiscal deficit of the government. The expenditure may not reflect in the fiscal deficit of the government, but it is there. It's just that it is on the books of FCI. So I think, you know, the first thing that needs to be done, and this is like, again, a pipe dream, you know, forget before the government actually ends up achieving the FRBM target. The first thing that they need to do is to start declaring the fiscal deficit properly. You know, some of it has happened in the last budget, but that's also not really good enough. What the government of India needs to declare is you know, is essentially the real deficit of the central government, the real deficit of the state governments, and you know, whatever has been, you know, a lot of public sector borrowing that happens in the name of the government, and it doesn't end up showing in the fiscal deficit. So what we need to report properly is the what we call the public sector borrowing requirement, and I don't think anyone in the government calculates that number right now. So
yeah, that's now one of the key points that keeps getting made over and over again in Dr. Viralacharya's book is that when bank balance sheets are so weak, they cannot support healthy credit growth. How do you explain that?
Right. So, you know, it's very simple. For every loan that banks give out, they need to allocate a certain amount of capital against it. Okay. So if the capital is limited, by its very definition, lending will be limited as well. Now, this is best visible in the fact that if you look at the overall lending carried out by public sector banks as a proportion if you look at the lending carried out by public sector banks as a proportion of overall lending carried out by banks, in 2010-11, it used to be around 74-75%. So 3/4 of the lending, outstanding loans, were given by public sector banks. In 2019-20, that had fallen to 57-58%. So obviously what is happening is that the market share of public sector banks is coming down dramatically over the years, and the reason for that is the fact that a lot of them just don't have enough capital to give out loans. So essentially, you know, this is what is called privatization by malign neglect, wherein even though the public sector banks themselves are not getting privatized, the sector in itself is getting privatized. And this is the impact of essentially banks not having enough capital.
True. Now, just continuing on that line, you know, Dr. Acharya asks in his book that should or can the valuable and sizable deposit franchises be sold off to private capital providers so that they can operate as healthy entities rather than be in an ICO? Is that truly going to work, or are we being just too optimistic that if we give away the good part to the private banks, that'll be safer?
Okay, so here's the thing. You know, this is obviously, you know, this is a question that anyone who's written a book on banking has thought about quite a lot, and including me and including Dr. Patel. And you know, the thing is that the people running the government, you know, be it the ministers or be it the bureaucrats, just don't have an incentive to let go of public sector units. Okay, and this is a point that R.C. Bhargav, the grand old man of Indian car industry, current chairman of Maruti Suzuki, makes, and a former IAS officer, makes in his new book. And he says that the administrative ministries have always been reluctant to give autonomy to their undertakings or to privatize them. In some instances, the undertakings are the main justification for the existence of the ministry. Now, to give you an example, very simple example, if you take Air India away and sell it off to someone, now what does, you know, the Ministry of Civil Aviation doesn't have, you know, it doesn't mean anything. Or if you take Coal India away and sell it off to someone, the Ministry of Coal has no value. If you take Steel Authority of India and sell it to someone, the Ministry of Steel has no value. So along similar lines, if you start selling public sector banks, then the Department of Financial Services has no value at all, which is why there is a great resistance to sell public sector banks and any other public sector entity for that matter, because you know, there are a lot of people who essentially would like the status quo to prevail. Also, you know, there's the question of you get how do you organize loan melas? If you look at how the government essentially pump primes the Indian economy, and this is a issue both Dr. Acharya and Dr. Patel discuss in great detail in their books, is that whenever the Indian economy is in a bad state, public sector banks are essentially encouraged to lend and ensure that economic growth comes back. So this is something that happened between 2009 and 2011 when Pranab Mukherjee was the finance minister and India was essentially dealing with a very low growth scenario because of the financial crisis, which had started in the US and then spread to other parts of the world. And because of the excessive lending that happened between that period, 2009 to 2011, banks ended up giving loans which they should not have. And then they ended up with, huge bad loans. But then, that part of the story came later. But at that point of time, Pranab Mukherjee, by encouraging banks, the late Pranab Mukherjee, by encouraging banks to give out loans, essentially ensured that India grew by 10%, which was like, the whole world was growing at 2%, 3%, and India was growing at 10%. Obviously, we had to sort of bear the cost in the years to come. Now, it's ultimately, as I said, it's all about incentives. And Urjit Patel actually sort of summarizes it beautifully in his book, where he says, where is the fun in owning banks if control over operations, managing them, and determining their regulation is not possible? Now, what happens because of this is that the country as a whole loses out. Now, the moment I talk about privatization of public sector banks, people, especially public sector bank employees, sort of respond with a lot of sarcasm that, but what about social obligations? It's not, banks are not about profitability, public sector banks. They're also about the government fulfilling social obligations. Now, here you need to sort of make a differentiation with the fact that the government is about social obligations. The public sector banks, public sector entities may not be, should not be about social obligations. And let me give you an example to explain this. A couple of hours before we were recording, I checked the market capitalization of State Bank of India and I checked the market capitalization of Kotak Mahindra Bank. The market capitalization of State Bank of India was around 1.77 lakh crore. The market capitalization of Kotak Mahindra Bank was 2.61 lakh crore. Okay, a difference of around 85,000 crore. What is the problem here? The problem is that Kotak Mahindra Bank is a puny bank in front of State Bank of India. So why does the market not give the right, a capitalization to SBI? Because they know that, the government and the babus are running it and they'll keep making a mess of it. Now, let's say the SBI was a properly run bank and, had some sort of a market capitalization given its size. So all, the social obligations that the government needed to fulfill, what all that was required was that every year you could sell a few shares of SBI, of, Punjab National Bank, of Bank of Baroda, and so many other public sector entities. And you could, carry out all the social obligations that you wanted to. But obviously, that's not going to happen because it's about control. It's not about doing the right thing. So.
True. Before I go to the last question, I just want to plug in something. You mentioned Mr. R.C. Bhargava's book that you right. also recently reviewed. I saw in Mint. So basically, R.C. Bhargava was on our show in From the Bookshelves of Forbes India, and we had interviewed him when the book came out, and it was a very fun interview. In case listeners want to watch it, you can just go back and please do listen to it. He talks at length about his experiences and everything while transforming Maruti Suzuki. Now, coming back to the last question before I let you go, what do you think is the most interesting point that Dr. Acharya is trying to make in this book? Also, because you understand banking far better than a lot of people. What is your view on the book?
Yes, I don't know about whether I understand banking.
Yes, of course you do. You already have a book too, which is a bestseller. People are just absolutely happy to read that book. I keep seeing it on Twitter.
That is also, that might just be, the book might have just been written to essentially turn my lack of understanding into some understanding, Pooja.
But I really hope that when Miss Acharya sees this video, and also you, I really hope that you guys in the next round look at the retail, some of us, and how retail NPAs are going to blow up in the ecosystem. Because I asked them also the last question in our interview, that what is his view on this entire retail NPA, and he was actually saying that, you know, people were paying from their credit, people were taking far more credit than they can afford. So yeah, that is one thing that I would like both of you to look retail, at.
Yeah, no, I can. I'll answer that question, and then I'll answer the question that you asked. So retail NPAs are going to be a big problem in the months to come. I mean, there's no denying that. The only issue is how big that problem will be. That, as of now, nobody really knows, because because of the RBI moratorium. So, you know, and now the Supreme Court is hearing the case. And so once all that's sorted out, only then will we get a clear picture as to how bad the scene's going to be. But the scene's going to be bad. I mean, that much I can tell you. Now, I think the most important point that Dr. Acharya makes in his book, and this is something I've sort of told him also about it, and I've also written about it at a couple of places, but I think it still needs to be made again. And I'll read out a long paragraph, and then I'll sort of analyze it. So he says that on the one hand, the overarching presence of public sector banks, other large state-owned financial institutions, example, the Life Insurance Corporation of India, and state-owned enterprises, creates the incentive that the government dominates the central bank and its financial sector policies to affect outcome for the entities it owns and for its borrowing program. On the other hand, the recognition that the government has incentives to influence policies as such, and that it is not at arm's length from regulators, driving the private sector into hyperactive lobbying. Read an overdose of consultations with the government and regulators. This in turn induces an overall culture in the system of putting in place business-friendly policies that are pro-incumbents at the cost of market-friendly policies that encourage creative destruction, asset reallocation, ease of doing business, and new entry. So, you know, and I'll give you an example. So if you look at the way the RBI has treated the real estate sector with kids' gloves, the guys are clearly not in a position to repay the loans. And you know, Dr. Patel says so very, very clearly in his book. And but then, you know, the loans have been restructured, and I mean, it's been going on and on. I'll sort of take this argument a little forward, and it's not just about restructuring loans. The fact that the government owns so many of these companies essentially leads to a situation where, one, it encourages crony capitalism, and it also, encourages private companies to demand things which are really not logical. So I'll give you an example. So if you look at the the current loan moratorium case, which is going on in the Supreme Court. So one of the problems there is how will interest be calculated? Okay. So basically, what has happened is, for the period of the moratorium, people have not paid repaid the principal or paid an interest on that loan. So that interest obviously has accumulated. Now, obviously, the debate is on how to charge that interest and how much interest to charge. So one of the arguments that the real estate sector made in the Supreme Court was that the interest that is charged on the outstanding loan should be equal just to the interest rate on deposits. Okay. Now, the problem with that argument is that, the banks have a lot of expenses other than the interest that they pay on deposits. I mean, they have employees to pay, salaries, they have rents to pay, and so on and so forth. But that's not the problematic point here. The problematic point here is that what is interest ultimately? Interest ultimately is price of money. Okay, sure. I make money and I put it in a bank, and the bank pays me an interest, a price. A bank pays me a price for that money so that I do not spend that money immediately. I postpone my consumption, right? So essentially, the real estate sector is asking the Supreme Court to decide on the price of money. Now, tomorrow, what stops any other sector, let's say banks, to approach the Supreme Court and ask the Supreme Court to decide on the price of homes? And you know, let's say the banking sector goes to the real estate, goes to the Supreme Court tomorrow and says that, you know, the real estate companies need to cut prices and sell their inventory because they need to repay loans, right? So the point is, all this happens because, you know, the government is so involved in all these companies in the system itself. So it leads to things which, you know, one, you know, it leads to crony capitalism, and two, it leads to very extremely highly illogical situations. So I think this is a point that, you know, comes out very strongly in Dr. Acharya's book. So it's not just about the banking system per se. It's about how, you know, the government being a part of so many companies and so many things essentially ends up hurting the overall system. It ends up hurting governance itself. So.
True, agree on that. Yeah, but I just wanted to add on that real estate part that you mentioned, and I've been thinking about it of late because I've been writing during the pandemic on real estate. Also, I think banks always had this thing that, you know, if the lender is selling at higher cost, and if buyers are going to buy at such a higher cost, I'll be able to, if somebody comes in and buys a house at 2 crores, then I'll be able to lend 2 crores and I'll be able to make money from that side. I also make money from the developer who's also has taken some construction loan from me. But now that the scenario is different and people have not been really doing sales over the last 4 or 5 years now, shouldn't banks really have taken an approach that, you know, okay, boss, now you have to start cutting down the price, or now let's at least get people to buy the house?
So the problem there is, you know, the money, obviously, that the loans that have been given out have been, you know, been given out against a certain collateral, right? And the collateral is essentially those unsold homes. So if the moment the prices are cut, the value of those collaterals fall, the value falls, the bank needs to recognize bad loans. So we go back to the earlier problem of a public sector banker not wanting to recognize bad loans as bad loans.
Sure.
It's all linked. And the only solution here is that, you know, banks should be run as banks and not as, you know, not as something which, you know, need to fulfill social obligations and stuff like that. So.
Cool. Perfect. Thank you so much for your time today.